On this episode of This Week in Space, we talk to NASA Deputy Administrator Pam Melroy about her career at NASA, her time as an astronaut, the delays to the Artemis lunar landing program, and much more. Join us.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
This is This Week in Space, episode number 98, recorded on February 16th, 2024. Inside NASA with Pam Melroy. This episode of This Week in Space is brought to you by Rocket Money. If I asked you how many subscriptions you have, would you be able to list them all and how much you're paying for them? If you would have asked me this question before I started using Rocket Money, I would have said yes, but let me tell you, I would have been so wrong. You've heard Leo Laporte talk about using Rocket Money. He made a political donation meant to be a one-time thing, but it turned out it was a recurring charge, but he wouldn't have known about it without Rocket Money. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has more than 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year with more than $500 million in canceled subscriptions. You can see all of your subscriptions in one place, and if you see something you don't want, you can cancel it with a single tap. You never have to get on the phone with customer service. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/twists. That's rocketmoney.com/twists. rocketmoney.com/twists. Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Space, the From the Heights of Space to the Top Brass of NASA edition. I'm Rod Pyle, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine. It's my enduring pleasure to be joined, as always, by the inexorable Tarek Malik, editor-in-chief of space.com. How are you, pal?
I'm doing well. Excited about today's episode. Very excited about
our me too. Yeah. Because today we're going to be joined by NASA Deputy Administrator Pam Melroy, which is a real treat. Now, Pam did join us briefly a few episodes back with a quick photobomb, but this will actually be a full sit-down interview, and we're just quivering in our captain's chairs.
Colonel, U.S. Air Force Colonel, retired Pam Melroy, space shuttle commander.
Well,
Pam
I was Melroy. Getting there.
Very exciting stuff.
So
I'm just sorry. I'm excited.
Ms. Melroy has a long history involvement in aviation, starting with the Air Force in the 1980s, including 200 combat flying hours. In 1994, she was selected as an astronaut, piloting two space shuttle missions and commanding a third, and was central to the construction of the International Space Station. She became deputy administrator of NASA, which is truly scaling the heights, in 2020 and remains in that slot today. And she'll be with us in just a few minutes. But a reminder, first, TWIT needs your help. We want to keep our show on the air and TWIT available to all. You can help for just $7 a month by joining Club TWIT. We'd really appreciate it. And we'll always do our best for you to say thank you. And now it's time for my trademark bad dad space joke.
They're never bad. Never.
So, Tarek.
Yes, Rod.
Why couldn't the astronaut book a room on the moon?
Why? Why? I need to know.
Because it was full, of course.
I love it.
Okay.
I think the full moon's coming up too.
Let's try another one. Okay. It's kind of a little lame one. Hey, Tarek.
Yes, Rod.
Why don't astronauts use Tinder?
Why not?
Because matches just don't work in space.
That's good.
That's actually good. Better, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. And very right. Timely. Very timely, because the NASA fire experiment just ended.
To being a good joke. Yeah. As always, we invite you to join the lame space joke squad and send us your best or worst space joke. We always appreciate your input. Don't make me do it, because if I do it, you end up with the two jokes like you just heard. Don't forget to do us a solid. Make sure to like, subscribe, and all that cool podcast stuff for us. After all, it's free. We love you. Show us you love us back. And now, on to headlines.
Yes. Yes.
So, yeah,
headlines. We got good ones this week.
Here we go.
A lot of good ones.
Yeah, so the one that's got us all scratching our heads, this kind of mixed messaging we're getting in the media, both popular and otherwise, about the Russian doomsday machine in orbit, which is not that at all. So give us the download on this.
Yeah, this is one. I know it's not just a Tarek story. When people who are not even like in my realm, like the people that are that like my friends call me to ask me about something. But yeah, this week we got confirmation that Russia is building a new anti-satellite weapon, that it may involve nuclear something of somehow. You know, we're not sure what that means, but this is a really weird one because earlier this week, a member of the House, you know, called on the White House to declassify the knowledge about this program because they wanted to be discussing it, you know, in Congress, and they had special meetings and whatnot, and it caused a big I don't want to say like a storm or like an uproar,
as Bugs Bunny would say, a furore.
In the Capitol, where they were just, everyone was abuzz with what is this. In fact, someone reached out to me to say they were really freaked out about it and like, what is it? What could it be? And it was confirmed to the point that it can be, because it's still a classified, apparently like super classified like fact that we know it, that Russia is building an anti-satellite program. It's not apparently in space at this moment. So it's a capability that they don't have right now. In fact, a White House spokesman said yesterday that there is no immediate threat to everyone on Earth or to it. But from what we can infer, it is some sort of anti-satellite weapon that would knock out other satellites in space. So things like your GPS, your communications network, that sort of stuff that we rely on, you know, every day. There is supposedly, and of course I can't confirm this because, you know, we didn't have the confirmation, some kind of nuclear angle. You know, maybe it's nuclear powered, maybe it's something else. We don't know. And we're going to have to see where this develops. But it's very interesting, because if it's an actual weapon to be deployed in space, that does run counter to the 1967 outer space, a peaceful uses of outer space treaty, which, you know, then calls into question if that's even valid, or if people can be held accountable to that at all, the countries that sign on to it. And so we'll have to see like what the next steps is in all of these discussions. But it's a really weird one, this whole situation, Rod. And, you know, we've seen a rise in anti-satellite tests, not just with Russia, but, you know, China has done one. India has done one recently. There's a rise for hypersonic missiles and missile defense. So this seems to be something else that we have to keep an eye on. I'll end with this. In the White House briefing yesterday, as we're recording this, it did come up very clearly that they said that there is a risk. These types of anti-satellite weapons can pose a risk, not just to satellites in orbit, but to any astronauts that are in orbit as well, because they need the same systems to work. So I was surprised to hear the mention of astronauts in that briefing, but it's there. And so that is like another measure of how important it is to keep track and figure out what's going on with this stuff.
Well, what's kind of frustrating, a little scary about this is, you know, we're kind of led, at least by the press accounts I've been reading, to believe this is some kind of kinetic weapon. But then there was, of course, the mention of some kind of nuclear aspect. So if this is a limited yield electromagnetic pulse weapon, I mean, can you do that in orbit without affecting ground systems? And if you do affect ground systems, how big a deal is it? And of course, this has been, you know, the subject of tons and tons of end of times fiction and so forth. And I don't want to go there, but it is a question people are asking. And I guess we're not going to know till we know, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's hope we don't have to find out, you know, the hard way where these are actually being demonstrated in space, because you knock out some satellites, there's a lot of satellites up there. And, you know, yeah, while we say there's a lot of space, eventually, you know, as we saw with Cosmos and Iridium, they can hit each other and cause lots and lots of damage and debris, and just it'll affect how we access space in the future. So I'm trying not to think of worst case scenarios for all this. Right now, what we know is that there's a weapon that's being developed that's not in space. It's not like in practical use right now. Mm-hmm. We don't know the specifics of it. A lot of it is classified. The fact that we even know it is supposedly classified, like how we know it and whatnot. So we'll have to just see what gets declassified in the near future, what gets revealed, and what the U.S. might develop to address this kind of a thing.
Well, or has already developed, and this is complete spitballing on my part. It has nothing to do with our interview with Pam Elroy later. It has nothing to do with anything I've read with NASA. But what country currently has the control over the most steerable active space assets? It's the U.S., because any Starlink satellite can be steered wherever you want to take it within a certain orbital band. Just saying. And, you know, They're kinetic in nature. All right. But moving on to more positive things. Oh, they're small, but they're big enough. You know, something the size of a kitchen table could put a real dent in your satellite. Private moon lander lifts off. Intuitive Machines is on the way.
That's right. That's right. This is a big success for this week. SpaceX had a triple play within 23 hours. They launched three different missions, and this was the first of those three. They launched the Odysseus Nova C Moonlander on the IM-1 mission for Intuitive Machines. That's a private company that is building these private spacecraft to take payloads for NASA, as well as for other customers to the moon. Launched the wee hours on Valentine's Day. It launched on the day after Valentine's Day. But it seems like it's doing well. And this is part of a $118 million contract that Intuitive Machines has with NASA as part of the commercial lunar payload services program, which is this whole partnership with companies to build commercial landers that then NASA either teams up with to get some space on or buys the whole thing outright to land a rover, a payload package, et cetera. For this mission, they're going to study plume interactions between the thrusters so they can understand what that works. There's some experiments for NASA, as well as there's a Jeff Coombs art installation on this one too. That's going to stay on the moon forever as part of that network, and it's really exciting because it seemed to go perfectly. And if everything continues to go well, it will land. We're hearing like in the afternoon of February 22nd, so not very long to get to the moon. Only about just over a week or so to get there, as opposed to some of the recent ones. And you know, we talked about the Astrobotic launch of Peregrine, which unfortunately did not manage to land on the moon. This one is also aimed at the South Pole. It's going to land in a crater that NASA's already flagged in that region, again as part of the agency's goal to get astronauts there in the next 2 years.
All right. And another mission we're going to talk about, which has been a tremendous success, but maybe nearing an end. But I can't look at this as a downer because of how astonishing it's been. And that's Voyager 1. And before we hear your take on this, I just want to remind people, this has been flying for 45 plus years. Mm-hmm. It's a machine that was designed with late 60s technology, flown in the late 70s. And since that time, and since leaving the solar system, let's just remember this thing is still running. You know, it records data on reel-to-reel tape with a big tape player like your grandfather had in his old Chevy, like an 8-track. And it's just astonishing that this, I mean, just the fact that that tape has managed to maintain its integrity, being dragged back and forth over a magnetic head all these years, along with everything else you have to do. Plus maintaining thrusters and guidance systems and internal temperatures and all this stuff with a little couple pellets of plutonium that are generating what's left of the amount of heat that they can because they're nearing their half-life. It's just incredible.
Yeah. And just for perspective, Voyager 1 launched on September 5th. 1977. So I'm about like a few months older, if anyone wants to do the math, than Voyager 1. And now here it is out in interstellar space. And what happened, at the end actually of last year, NASA, sent out an alert to say that Voyager 1 has a problem. Basically, it has the computer issue, with its, flight data system. It's not, it had a backup system, but the backup went offline in 1981. So decades ago, it's been running on this primary one, since then. And the system is not kind of talking correctly with another vital system. It's telemetry modulation unit, this thing called a TMU. And so it can't send any science or engineering data back to Earth. And actually it had a hiccup in December and they had to reestablish contact, with the spacecraft. And so NASA still hasn't been able to regain full functionality, with the spacecraft, and they're hoping that they can, but this, it just might be, an issue where, you know, the spacecraft is 47 years old and maybe it can't bounce back from this, when it's so far away. It takes forever. You know, it's like 100, And it's this 149. I'm trying to do the math because it's 162 AUs, astronomical units, from our planet. And one astronomical unit is the distance between the Earth and the sun. So 162 times that, that's how far.
Yeah, I was going to say it's a lot more than a couple of AU. Yeah. It's many billions.
So the NASA is working on it. You know, it's not dead, which I think is the important takeaway. And if you're going to be really sad about Voyager 1, Voyager 2 is still going strong, launched in the same year and actually launched before Voyager 1. And it's off on a different part of, I believe, interstellar space doing its own thing. So they will at least have that be able to try to see how long they can keep that one going. But I tell you, Voyager 1 has been one of those success stories that you're surprised it's still going. And then you're surprised, you know, when it goes offline, if it's going to do. But we're going to knock on wood that the folks at NASA and that JPL can turn this one around and get it talking to the right systems again.
Well, and what a success story. And I'll just remind people, I bring this up every time we talk about Voyager, but, you know, this program has been, besides being an incredible icon of longevity and reliability, it's operating on a few million dollars a year, well, less than $10 million, I believe, mm-hmm. or maybe closer to 18. But it's a couple of old Sun workstations on a couple of banquet tables tucked away in a corner of JPL. This isn't a big thing at Mission Control. It does take dish time for the Deep Space Network. But once those command strings go back and forth, and we're talking about something that's 15.2 billion with a B miles away right now. Yeah. So, you know, you're flinging signals way out into the ether and looking for this flickering handful of watts signal being transmitted back when it is. But it's being run on an absolute shoestring and has been for a couple of decades. So this is, it's something that we'll certainly mourn, but it has fulfilled its destiny many times over.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we will be back in just a few seconds with NASA Deputy Administrator Pam Melroy for this very special edition. Stay with us. Don't go anywhere.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
What's the best part of a Dunkin' run? The coffee or the dollar donut? $2 stuffed bagel minis or $3 sausage, egg, and cheese you can add to that coffee? Or the fact that you get to leave the office? The answer, of course, is yes. Time for a Dunkin' run. Great deals on food for $1, $2, or $3 with a medium or larger coffee. America runs on Dunkin'. Excludes specialty donuts and fancies. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.
And we're here today talking with Pam Melroy, Deputy Administrator of NASA. Pam, it's a real honor to have you back with us, since you did join us oh so briefly a couple of months ago when we had our Phoenix photobomb session, which I really enjoyed. But mainly, I just want to say thank you for taking time out of what I know is a really, really busy schedule. We appreciate it a lot.
Oh, I'm very happy to talk to you both, Rod and Tariq. I'm happy to be here. And that was really fun, photobombing your session.
And I got to thank Greg Autry for setting that up, because I suspect it was his idea, wasn't it?
It totally was Greg's idea.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. I got to pay him back for that one of these days. So I just would like to start with a really broad general question, because I think a lot of people really don't know what a deputy administrator does at NASA. We have a general idea of what the administrator does because we see him or her quite a bit on camera. But being a deputy administrator is kind of different, and I suspect a lot more operational, is it not?
I think that's probably a good way of putting it. I could laughingly say I do all the things that that he doesn't want to do, and that's certainly part of it. But I think really I kind of have one foot both in the, you know, political world. I am a political appointee, so I have those responsibilities of coordinating with the White House. Certainly do a lot with my interagency partners. I think that's important, but I'm also more down and in and looking at the execution of the priorities that the administrator has and helping to make sure that those activities are going along the way they need to be.
And I would assume, Pam, that your experience flying in space brings a lot to the table when you're looking at all the day-to-day work, the big missions too. I mean, it seems like there's always something happening now, not just at NASA, but in space that you have to wrangle and keep on top of.
That's true. And you know what's really interesting about it? I certainly didn't set out to do this, but NASA is more than human spaceflight, of course. It's the Science Mission Directorate. It's aeronautics and it's space technology development. So what's interesting about that is I actually have a master's degree in planetary science and undergraduate in physics and astronomy. And I was a test pilot. So it's really fun. I have a special place in my heart for every single part of the portfolio. I'm so interested in it. And just, you know, that's really the best part of my job is to hear from all these people who are doing these amazing things every day. They teach me so much.
You know, and I just had one quick follow-up to that about the space bug, because, you know, I did follow your career, you know, through the Air Force Reserve, you know, into NASA there. But were you bitten by the space bug prior to that, or did it catch you, you know, through your work as a test pilot, your work studying planetary science, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I was definitely one of those people who was bitten by the Apollo bug. And I would say that that was true of a lot of astronauts, but also a lot of test pilots, scientists and engineers that I met. Really, it just kind of unleashed this whole tidal wave of kids interested in STEM and in exploration and in aviation, which is pretty cool because I'm hoping Artemis does the same thing.
I don't think you're old enough to have been bitten by the Apollo bug, at least not as directly as I was.
Absolutely. Within about a year of the moon landing. So I was just about to turn 8 on the first moon landing. And so I would say certainly by the time I was 10 years old, it was the second thing you learned about me after my name. I'm Pam Melroy. I'm going to be an astronaut.
Peggy Whitson says 8 is the... Peggy Whitson told me that 8 is the formative year. That's the year that if it's going to get you, it's going to get you. So.
Well, I was 8 during Gemini, so yeah. I look at NASA administrators and deputies over the years, and just talking about administrators for a minute, what we've tended to see is politicians and then engineers and then possibly astronaut engineers. And it seems like you kind of need to have all three in one person, but that's hard to find. I mean, in you, we have a person who understands planetary science and I'm sure engineering because you were a test pilot and being an astronaut. But, you know, what makes a perfect deputy administrator beyond you, of course?
Yeah, actually, I think you're really pulling on something that's really important, which is that what you really need is an ideal team. And I think from the very beginning, the administrator basically said, look, this is what I'm good at. I need someone who's good at these other things. And there was trust and a relationship between us. In fact, the really interesting part about that was, especially when we had Bob Cabana as our associate administrator, is after about 4 or 5 months, it kind of dawned on me that we had all fallen very quickly into something that was really natural for us, which is to behave like a crew. And in a crew, people have different job assignments, but they support each other. And there's, you know, so much respect for the expertise that that each of the individuals brings. Mm. And so I think really what you're looking for is not so much trying to get the whole package in one person, because I agree with you. I think that would be really hard, but I think we have a strong package in tandem with each other. And that's really the way to solve the problem. But it's critical that you work together as a team to make that efficient and make it work.
You know, Pam, one of the big questions that Rod and I had that we wanted to ask you today is kind of where you see the priorities of U.S. Human spaceflight taking us. We've seen a lot of things going on. Of course, the recent Artemis 1 flight, which was amazing to see that SLS get off the pad on that flight, and of course the ongoing work for Artemis 2. So I'm curious if there is a hierarchy that you kind of hew to. For what you see as like the primary priorities for NASA in human spaceflight, is it you know the moon first and then orbit? Is it a mix of all of those things? I know there was a talk earlier this week in Congress about the future of the ISS, you know, as it winds down, mm-hmm. and the subsequent stations to come there. So I'm just curious, how do you approach that from an operational standpoint about where we need to go together and how to get there?
Yeah, it's actually really just fascinating work. And the philosophy that I bring to it is that you actually have to start mentally at the destination, paint the picture of what it is you're trying to achieve. What would good look like? What is it that you're actually trying to do? And then what happens then is then that's called architecting from the right. And then you flow backwards and say, okay, what are the things that we need as a part of that vision? What do we have to achieve to achieve that vision? And the challenge always is, of course, because you're dealing with everything that you're doing today. We continue to execute operationally everything we're doing today. So you have to recognize you're also executing from the left. And the challenge is really focusing on the future and how you are going to transition from where you are today to where you're trying to get to. So the key insight really about what we're trying to do is that this is not about the moon. It's not about Mars. It's actually about a sustained human presence and responsible exploration throughout the solar system. This is what I believe the American people wants from us. I mean, how many times have you heard it? Well, why did we go to the moon and then we didn't go anywhere else? And, you know, look at the proliferation of science fiction out there. And it's like, when do we make this giant leap that humans are going to go off the planet and in a persistent way and a sustained way? And it is an awesome vision. But all of a sudden, a lot of things become clear. I mean, we learn from station logistics. People need supplies to support mm-hmm. them. So all of a sudden, you start flowing that down. And it really became clear that if we don't practice this on the moon, it's going to be way hard to do it at the next destination. And so ideally, we're going to practice this on the moon and kind of polish up what we consider a blueprint, like, okay, this is what you need, this is what you need, this is what you need. We learned a lot from building the space station, which we would like to transfer those lessons learned to LEO, to commercial destinations. They're not going to look like ISS. We have stuff on ISS we use every day, like 1,000 times a day, like we wish we had more of it or more capability, and stuff we don't use at all. So the idea is to practice, to learn. Let's go do a demo on Mars and let's start thinking about where the next destination is after that.
And from that, I guess from that description is the priority then, because you mentioned it's not the moon or Mars, like in terms of a specific end goal. It sounds as if you're saying it's the capability to be able to do what we might want to do later on that you're looking to get to, things like, you know, having those deep space exploration vehicles, suits, all of the systems, that partnership with commercial. Is that kind of the idea that you mean there? Yeah, I just want to make sure that I understood that right. So
yeah, Ron, we shouldn't be looking at like this, that, like I need this cat and that dog. It's really about what do we need to do science throughout the solar system with humans. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a key part of that is actually going to be human machine teaming as well. So we're going to, I mean, this is a cross agency strategy because we have to do tech development. We also have to understand a new way of doing science for our science mission directorate that actually puts humans in the loop in the decision-making process at the front line.
All right. Well, we're going to be back with my next burning question after this quick break. So stay with us.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
What's the best part of a Dunkin' run? The coffee or the dollar donut? $2 stuffed bagel minis or $3 sausage, egg, and cheese you can add to that coffee? Or the fact that you get to leave the office? The answer, of course, is yes. Time for a Dunkin' run. Great deals on food for $1, $2, or $3 with a medium or larger coffee. America runs on Dunkin'. Exclude specialty donuts and fancies. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.
So, Pam, we recently had an announcement from NASA that there would be what was termed as a delay to the remaining Artemis missions, especially Artemis III, the first landing. But from my viewpoint in the bleachers, being a journalist and not a NASA official, this really just kind of puts us back on the original timetable that was accelerated by the Trump administration, if I'm reading my cues correctly. So when we originally heard about Artemis II and Artemis III, they were out about where they've returned to. So it feels like we've kind of returned to that. And this is less of a delay and kind of more of a return to an achievable schedule, especially considering some of the major challenges that have to be overcome before you can do a human landing.
Not quite. I think NASA was looking at 28 to 30.
Right.
They were thinking that was achievable. I think we can beat that. I do think we can beat that. But we also have to realistically acknowledge even those assumptions are based on perfect success of every mission. And while Artemis 1 was a success by any measure, there was a lot of learning that happened. And I think that's a more realistic set of expectations, is that you're going to find things on the way. You know, these are test flights, and no test flight ever goes perfectly. There's, you hope for lessons learned that allow you to go fly as quickly as possible, but you have to tackle what you know. Because, you know, you're developing a capability that we want to use for a decade or more. Right. So, you know, an operational capability. So you got to tackle that stuff right up front before you put certainly put a crew on board.
And that crew is training right now for Artemis II. I mean, we saw, I think, some water training earlier. I think we've got a look inside the capsule. What are you hoping to see in terms of improvements in either the vehicle or that training, you know, that the extra time is going to get you, NASA, and the team overall?
Well, we definitely have some analysis we're still working through. I think we're very close on closing on what the issues are around what we saw, more charring than we expected that our models showed us for the heat shield. But in addition to that, we've discovered some electronics issues that are going to require to pull some electronics out and put it back in. And, you know, of course, the crew module is going to be built from the inside out. So those become in the critical path going forward. And that's really what we needed the extra time for. I think the crew is actually grateful for this. I reflect on my own personal experience on one of the first ISS assembly missions. And I can tell you, I was on three assembly missions, and the training for each one of them was very different, and it was better every time. On the third assembly flight, ISS 3A, that was the one that I was on, some of the procedures that we had, we were making up as we went along, because the ops had not yet, the maturity wasn't there until the hardware got on orbit. And really, the integration was happening real time. And we had a lot of issues. I spent a lot of time looking at the software on station, looking at known bugs and other features, and training around that. And so I think the crew is really helping to write the procedures as they go. So they can absolutely use that extra time. It's sort of the first time the crew meets the hardware really face to face. And all of a sudden you find out all kinds of things that will maybe not work perfectly the way they were planned.
Well, and this brings up a really good point of, and you talked about this earlier, about this being kind of the experimental steps in a lot of ways we have to take for moving on to Mars and beyond. So looking at, so we've got the SLS, we've got the Orion capsule, both have worked brilliantly so far. Then we've got these two lunar landers under development, for now anyway, maybe more later, and a lot of other technology, EVA suits and so forth. But I think one thing that is still kind of unclear to a lot of folks, at least in general public, is sort of what the big picture is. You know, where, when does the base or the semi-permanent habitat on the surface get placed? When does Gateway come into play? And what's the big picture in terms of long-term lunar exploration? Could you just address that in a nutshell?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible to go online. We have an architecture concept and which we update every year as we learn new things, but also as we bring new international partners on who are developing elements and putting those pieces in play. I would say we are right at the cusp of all the conversations that you're talking about. We're talking about pressurized and unpressurized rovers because mobility is a key aspect of being able to do science. Just one of my favorite statistics, it took 25 years for all the rovers on Mars to finally exceed the distance traveled during Apollo on the moon.
Right.
And so those rovers really are important because they broaden the horizon of the science that you can get done. You can have a much greater diversity in terms of samples and just sort of understanding someplace as a whole planet. So those things are really, really important. And those are definitely I will say, full play right now. And we are having discussions about habitats. And I think when we analyze the habitat situation, it's actually not clear whether we need like one place that you always go to. I think we think in the end that's probably the right thing to do, that because then you can concentrate the infrastructure like the power grid and so forth. But even if you look at communications, if you're going to be sending rovers out everywhere, do you need a pup tents? And what about the comms situation? Do you want a 5G network on the moon? Is everything being bounced up to orbit? How is that working? So I would say a huge part that is happening inside the agency right now and with our international partners. And, you know, it sounds great to just, well, when are you going to build a moon base?
Right.
This is really about getting to the point of, well, what are the real requirements for this? And that's what we're in the middle of that requirements development.
Well, and it's just, I just have to say for the peanut gallery, it is so exciting to see those of us who have written or read a lot about the Apollo program know that there is planning for a semi-permanent base and planning for heavy cargo versions of the lunar module that would be able to keep people there longer and all that. But we were operating right on the bleeding edge of that technology, and it's amazing it worked as well as it did. But now you've got so much more potential. We're just, as non-passengers, passive watchers, we're so excited to see this. I can see that Tarek is burning to ask you a question, and he will as soon as we come back from this break. Stay with us.
Save big money at Menards. Gorilla tapes, glues, and adhesives are perfect for jobs around the house, indoors and out. Gorilla Heavy Duty Construction Adhesive has a 100% waterproof formula that provides a secure bond on any surface. From trim work to landscape block to hanging mirrors, it's all purpose and holds in 30 seconds. Pick it up for your project and head to Menards.com to see all of our great deals going on now.
Save big money at Menards.
What's the best part of a Dunkin' run? The coffee or the dollar donut? $2 stuffed bagel minis or $3 sausage, egg, and cheese you can add to that coffee? Or the fact that you get to leave the office? The answer, of course, is yes. Time for a Dunkin' run. Great deals on food for $1, $2, or $3 with a medium or larger coffee. America runs on Dunkin'. Excludes specialty donuts and fancies. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.
Well, Pam, you know, we've been talking a lot about human spaceflight. And of course, you know, as like the spaceship person at space.com, I get very excited about that. But this week has been really exciting, too. Actually, I should say the last few weeks, because you've got some NASA payloads already headed to the moon on the Intuitive One, the Intuitive Machines One, the Odysseus, which is a really pretty name for a moon lander that just launched this week. And of course, we saw the first the first private moon lander from the U.S., Astrobotics Peregrine, launched last month with its own, I would say its own successes and, of course, its own learning curve that came from that one. But it seems like that part of it, that commercial partnership with NASA is really heating up, which we've seen that pay off with the commercial crew and the commercial cargo services with SpaceX and Northrop Grumman. But this seems like a new regime that is now coming to bear fruit. You've got several different payloads on the IM-1 mission going to the South Pole to land in a crater, which we know is a target for Artemis 3. I'm just kind of curious what the feeling is like now at NASA to kind of be at this point where you're seeing these commercial partnerships really starting to pay off. And what does that mean for the model for the future of uncrewed operations on the moon?
Yeah, I think what you're seeing is actually a convergence. There's just no question that this is a whole of agency strategy for exploration into the solar system. And so the CLPS, kudos to Astrobotic. They were incredibly responsible, but what we really loved is that they were very transparent about what was going on. I think that's really important culturally as we go forward with lots of people landing on the moon, to be able to share that information. So there was definitely learning that happened there, but they really handled themselves incredibly professionally and responsibly. And we all learned from that, and we're talking with them about next steps. Super excited about Intuitive Machines. We're keeping our fingers crossed. It's very hard to do this. As you know, a lot of people have failed. I think it's important to know, though, that Intuitive Machines lander, Odysseus, has both science and technology payloads, but also exploration enabling payloads. And the one that I think of as being critically important is the one that set of cameras looking at the plume surface interaction. Mm-hmm. We don't know a lot about that. And that's a really big deal, because if you find out when you land, your plume goes very long distances, that helps us understand about non-interference with other landers and other activities going on. I mean, that's going to be critical information going forward. So they are a part. They are just the vanguard. And I think it's exactly what we see on Mars, right? We have the robotic explorers that are giving us the information and helping to prepare for when we're doing a full up science investigation with humans involved. So this really is a reflection of that. As far as the commercial aspect of it, I think this makes perfect sense. What we saw on LEO was that communications and transportation are well understood business models. And that's where you see them starting, right? Mm-hmm. With those kinds of business models. But then we start to see other things like, you know, what's happening with communications to the ground, direct to your cell phone. So I think what you're going to see is the next steps that will happen on the moon are going to be around those infrastructure capabilities. And then there's clearly a model for services that you can build on. So stay tuned. I don't think the tech is there quite for those yet, but that's what the next step would likely be.
So we've worked through a very small percentage of the questions that we had. We're going to have to just go without getting a few answered. But I did want to shift gears for a second to you. I mean, you had a very different spaceflight career, but a magnificent one nonetheless. Was there a particular moment during either in space or on the ground while you're preparing to go, anything to do with your career with flight, it was really your aha, this is where it all comes together moment for you? Something that really got you right there?
Yeah, wow. Too many to count, almost. you know, going to space is such an amazing experience. One of the things that it gives you is a perspective on the space industry where everything comes together. you know, we tend to have a fairly siloed industry. Like I'm, you know, a launch person, or I build satellites, or I know all about communications. And when you're in space on a spacecraft, you're intimately involved with all of those things. And so you see how they come together at the end. And I think that's what really happened on my first space flight. I just began to understand how all those pieces come together and how interrelated and reliant we are. But I think there's also personal moments, certainly on my last flight when we had an emergency, which I referred to in the last podcast. What I really saw was the critical nature of the building of culture basically eats planning for lunch. I mean, we didn't plan that, right? We didn't plan to do that. I thought we planned for every contingency, and we hit a contingency that no one had really thought about. But the important thing was that the team had developed a culture of methodical problem solving cooperatively, and they were experts in their area. And that cooperative relationship with each other and with the ground enabled us to solve that problem. I mean, if you thought I solved it, I can tell you I didn't. I stood back, you know, writing on my notes like, well, let's make sure we answer all these questions. I didn't have to say a word. The teams on the ground and my astronaut crew asked all those questions and solved all those problems. And so as a leader, it's like one of the proudest moments of your life. You're like, they didn't need me today because they had the culture to solve the problem themselves.
And for you listeners who may have forgotten that contingency that Pamela is mentioning is during the STS-120 mission, we had a torn solar wing that spacewalkers had to go out and stitch up, and it was pretty exciting to see and to watch in real time. I can say, you know, I know that time is tight, Pam, but I did want to ask about the promise ahead, not just for astronauts, but for female astronauts and scientists in the future. You are, of course, one of the few female space shuttle pilots, space shuttle commanders as well. And it seems like with more and more spacecraft coming on, those opportunities are going to grow in the future. NASA plans to land the first woman on the moon with Artemis 3. And if you can touch on kind of how things are different now, what people should keep in mind, what young women should keep in mind in terms of setting those goals and how to achieve them. I think my daughter would really love to hear that too. And I wanted to make sure that she hears what you have to say there. So.
Well, I think I will say certainly at times in my career, especially being sort of at the front end of women going into military pilot, certainly being a test pilot, being a pilot astronaut, there are people who are uncomfortable with you being there, and you're not necessarily made to feel welcome immediately. And that's not a great feeling. But having said that, what I found was that if I kept my eye on the ball, which is I want to be a space shuttle commander and I think I can do this and I'm going to go do it. When you have something that you're really aspiring to, it reminds you that those are just, you know, those things come and go. And certainly after a relatively short period of time, usually you just become part of the crew and part of the team. And you know, frankly, in some cases, the exception to the rule, and that's okay. We're in such a different place right now. There's plenty of role models out there. I had a pilot say to me once, I've never flown with a woman pilot. So I had to say, that's okay. I've flown with lots of guys. I'll show you how it's done. We don't have that problem anymore. We are integrating women at all levels in what we do. And, you know, really the key thing is the warmth, the camaraderie, the teamwork. It's really like a family, and families have men and women. So I think we've got a model going forward.
Well, Pam, this has been fantastic. Again, we really appreciate you taking time to join us today. It's been very special. Your Twitter/X handle is @Astro_Pam. That's @Astro_Pam. Do you have any other places you'd like to direct people to follow you?
Well, I'm also pretty active on LinkedIn. I like to put some longer pieces there, particularly around technology that excites me and I'm really enthusiastic about. Thanks for asking.
Thank you. And we look forward to seeing more of you in the future.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Rod and Tariq. It was great.
Tarek, where can we keep an eye on your stellar achievements?
Well, as always, you can find me at space.com and on the X. Are we calling it that? Pam called it that. Twitter.
Well, she's an important person. We're not, so I guess so.
We'll go with that at Tarek J. Malik. And of course, this weekend, you will find me following closely on Pins and Needles as we follow the Odysseus moonlander on the way to the moon. Landing is February 22nd. That's like less than a week from now. So stay tuned.
All right. And you can always find me crouching over at pilebooks.com and my creaky website, or at adastromagazine.com, which is not creaky. And if you want something in print or a digital magazine form, it's your best source for what's happening in space. Don't forget to drop us a line at twis@twit.tv. That's twis@twit.tv. We always welcome your comments, suggestions, and ideas, and we respond to each and every email. And I really appreciate people sending in commentary and ideas, and we do listen, and we do roll them into the show. And don't forget to check out space.com, the website's in the name, and the National Space Society at NSS.org, where we'd love you to become a member. Both are good places to satisfy your spaceflight cravings. New episodes of this podcast publish every Friday on your favorite podcatcher, so make sure to subscribe, tell your friends, give us thumbs up, reviews, likes, 5 stars, extra cookies, whatever they ask for, because we love you and we want you to love us back. You can also head to our website at twit.tv/TWIS. Finally, don't forget you can get all the great programming on the Twit Network ad-free on Club Twit, as well as some extras that are only available there for just $7 a month. You've heard Leo talk about the tough times facing podcasters. We're no exception. So this is your chance to step up and be counted. You can also follow the Twit Tech Podcast Network at Twit on Twitter/X and on Facebook, and twit.tv on Instagram. Thank you very much, and we will see you all next time. Bye-bye, everybody.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
What's the best part of a Dunkin' run? The coffee or the dollar donut? $2 stuffed bagel minis or $3 sausage, egg, and cheese you can add to that coffee? Or the fact that you get to leave the office? The answer, of course, is yes. Time for a Dunkin' run. Great deals on food for $1, $2, or $3 with a medium or larger coffee. America runs on Dunkin'. Excludes specialty donuts and fancies. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer. Terms apply.